This podcast is a talk on the Kibbutzim given by Gavin to a workers' solidarity meeting in Dublin. You can find more podcasts and articles at our website at www.wsm.ie.
Okay, so the kibbutz has pluralized its kibbutzim, and it's a movement, a social movement with a long history. It goes back and has a lot of overlap with anarchism and communism in particular. It's comprised of a lot of different ideological streams and different currents and philosophies, and many of them are contradictory and have different intentions. But I think it is also useful for us to think about it and look at what it has been historically. So, quick history. The first aliyah, the plural of aliyah is aliyot, which means ascension, or it's a, you know, I don't know, it has some religious meaning, because the first Aliyah was largely a religious movement. It happened between 1882 and 1903, and it was mostly Jews trying to get back to the land and to try to have, you know, get away from persecution in Eastern Europe and Russia. In fact, at some point, it was actually supported by the Tsars and Tsarist officials, because they wanted to get the Jews out of there anyhow. But, you know, they were escaping pogroms and wanted to be able to celebrate their religion and culture without persecution. So the second Aliyah was very different in character. It happened between 1903 and 1914, and it took with it a lot of the sort of revolutionary climate of Russia and Eastern Europe at the time. It was a complicated mixture, but it was very socialist, non-traditional Marxist and Zionism mixed together, including non-state Zionism, or anti-state Zionism, was also included in some of those strains, which is sort of anti-state cultural Judaism. It's kind of complicated to describe, but it also sort of forms what the sort of baseline of what the kibbutz was thought of as the classical kibbutz movement. And it was very socialist in character. So Degania is a currently existing kibbutz in Israel that was formed during this period. It's actually kibbutzah, which is means it's smaller. It's like around 100 or so people. It's like a kibbutzah, so it's smaller than a kibbutz, but it has basically the same function. Degania still exists today. However, it's like been largely privatized. People have wage labor, and they hire wage laborers that don't also have membership in the kibbutz. So it's changed in character a lot. The third Aliyah, the fourth, it was from 1919 to 1923. The fourth Aliyah was from 1924 to 1929, and the fifth Aliyah was from 1929 to 1939. And they carried many more individuals into Palestine and swelled the numbers of the kibbutz. And they had various different reasons for those separations, historical reasons. But they're less interesting because they didn't change the character as much. So, in parallel with the collectivist movements, members of the Third Aliyah were broadly interested in emulating the Bolshevik Revolution. So at that time, we saw the formation of the Histadrut, which was a union, a trade union organization in Israel that was structured initially somewhat like the Soviets. By 1927, the Histadrut had 75% of the Jewish labor force in Palestine, which was enormous. So it's kind of interesting. Now, this was taken over, basically, by Ben-Gurion. He's largely responsible for going in there, creating a much more hierarchical situation and turning it into a nationalist Zionist organization. And that didn't work out too well. The classical notion of the kibbutz is formed by the second Aliyah, as I said. Now, it's interesting, the first Aliyah was only about 35,000 Jews moving into Palestine, so it was incredibly small, and it didn't have a big impact on, and didn't set the tone because it was so small. By comparison, about 2 million Jews left during that same period to come to the United States. So, the kibbutzim of the second Aliyah were usually communists, taking the maximum from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. They attempted to remove all exploitation of labor within the commune, and at this time, they didn't hire wage laborers externally. They relied on their own labor, and a lot of there is a lot of sort of like rugged character to it, getting back to the land and like eschewing you know, some of the stereotypes of the Jew that had developed, like handling money and stuff like that. So they wanted to have an honest labor and have no exploitation. During this period, idealism was strong and they had really revolutionary notions. The cultural heritage was re-examined. They played a lot with the ideas of their cultural heritage, and there was a lot of changes in the way that they celebrated Judaism in general. And it was a very secular form of Judaism that's typified by like reports about Degania during that period. It was intentionally egalitarian, but in practice, it was actually quite sexist. Like you hear reports of some of the women saying that in practice, the women would do all of the house labor and childcare. But you know, in terms of their rhetoric, it was less sexist. So the debate on feminism and the role of women in the kibbutz came up frequently during the Second Oliphant period. So the kibbutzim that were formed during this time were extremely, they were oppressively communitarian almost. So all children were taken away from the parents and placed in collective situations. The kids would sleep in collective rooms away from the parents, and this caused a lot of sort of strife and difficulty with parents. New parents would have difficulty moving their kids into these situations. They slept in common halls. Dining was communal. At some points, I think it was in Degania, you weren't allowed to have a teapot, because if you had a teapot, you might go to your room and talk with somebody outside of the community. So just to give you an idea of like how communitarian it was. Okay, so moving on to capitalism and its relationship with the kibbutz. The kibbutzim didn't all retain this sort of communist character. The ability of the kibbutzim to be self-sufficient seemed possible up to the point that expansion was required. And once they ended up in a situation when they felt that they needed to acquire new land or new capital, they often would attempt to gain capital in some ways. So during the 70s and 80s, it became particularly bad because Israel's currency was undergoing hyperinflation. And because of the hyperinflation of the Israeli currency, they were taking out loans at enormous interest rates, but it wouldn't matter, or they hoped it wouldn't matter. The inflation rate was as high as 400%. So they took out these huge loans, and then when the currency stabilized, kibbutzim were left with massive debt. Now, in this period, you see, like, once they start having this massive debt that they have to pay back, they start doing all kinds of things to avoid insolvency or to have their, you know, their lands taken away as collateral. And so this is where you start seeing like the factory kibbutzim and having wage laborers, often Thai wage laborers, hired on from externally in order to exploit labor. So many of the collectivist and communist kibbutzim still survive, though, actually, in Israel. A lot of them don't have continuity, but are formed by members of existing kibbutzim that moved off of one that became privatized and sort of collected into ones that were not privatized. There's a lot of negative sentiment in the kibbutz movement in Israel comes from increasing nationalism and religiosity of the mainstream rather than the kibbutzim. During the Ethiopian Aliyah, I don't know if you know this, but there was some sector of the Ethiopian population that decided to self-identify as Jewish and move to Israel. During this period, the government banned absorption of these immigrants into the kibbutzim because they were afraid that they would stop being religious, because the kibbutzim are still largely secular. So they were afraid that they would infect them with their secularism, so they weren't allowed in. So the history of anarchism in the kibbutz there's a confused relationship here, but there are some aspects of overlap. From the earliest days of the kibbutz formation, there's been talk about anarchist communism among members. The ideas of Kropotkin were quoted by many prominent individuals in the kibbutz movement and more broadly in the workers' movement in Palestine. The Hebrew language, which was basically dead for over 1,000 years, was newly being revived, especially with the kibbutz movement and the first Aliyah started. And this was especially true on the kibbutzim. And one of the first books to be translated into Hebrew was Kropotkin's Mutual Aid. So I think that's actually pretty significant, because there weren't too many things being translated into Hebrew at the time. The notion of mutual aid never became a huge factor in the kibbutz movement. Although there were a bunch of kibbutzim, they never had strong economic ties between them. They never sort of federated into anything larger than, you know, a few. There are a few examples of trading members or giving goods and stuff like that in good faith, but it never became a really systematic approach to it. So they can't give us much information about, you know, a federated communism or communism on a larger scale than a couple hundred members. So in 1997, 1998, there were three workshops on anarchism in the kibbutz that were held at Yad Tevenkin. Yad Tevenkin is the research and documentation center of the United Kibbutz Movement. And in his opening remarks, Chaim Seligman said, "We in the kibbutz movement are currently in a situation in which we must find solutions to a long line of internal and external problems. There are in the vast treasury of philosophers such as Gustav Landauer, Bernard Lazar, Kropotkin, and Paul Goodman philosophical elements that can assist us in advancing our thinking. When the movement is in a process of change, we must enable the vacuum to be filled with new constructive contents. In anarchism, as in utopian thought, we can find such constructive contents." So there are some people who are advocating anarchist-communist ideas among kibbutz members and in conferences there. So I also want to talk about the urban kibbutz. So there's a statement by Kropotkin. "This is why I've long since thought that if I were one of those who start colonies, I should never go into the wilderness. A communist colony? Well, the best spot for that is near London or near Paris." So that's it. He was trying to keep people from going off to Siberia and starting communes, or in Australia is another place that people were doing this. So one of the biggest trends in the modern kibbutz movement has been formation of kibbutzot in urban environments, so smaller kibbutz-like elements in urban environments, with the notion of trying to affect the broader population rather than just being a sort of, you know, self, you know, just a hole somewhere, as some comrades said at the strategy meeting. So the one reason for this trend is an increasing sense of responsibility to the community. The kibbutz movement has been largely isolated. Even though it includes 5% of the population of Israel, it's never had a strong engagement with the rest of society. There is the fact that a lot of ex-kibbutz members hold prominent political positions and are involved in army positions and as officers and stuff like that. So that has had a big effect, and it also probably creates something of a backlash in the rest of the community in Israel against the kibbutzim. So Tamala's kibbutz is an urban kibbutz which has members of the kibbutz give 100% of their income. They work as wage laborers at various things like lawyers and, you know, school teachers, etc. And they give all their money to communal coffers. And it's used to pay for communal goods such as housing, maintenance, and a stipend is distributed to members to purchase food and other goods. And there's a big focus on individualism, much more so than existed in the traditional kibbutzim. Decisions are made in councils of members, and decisions don't require unanimity or even a majority, but they go by some kind of sense of the feeling of the meeting. So,
long meeting.
Yeah, I can imagine. Members who will be responsible for the work required to carry out some idea are disproportionately affected by the decisions, are sort of given more weight in the meeting. So social activism is one of the major aims of the Tamala's kibbutz. Many of the members grew up in kibbutzim themselves and wanted a more urban lifestyle and more community involvement, and so that's the main reason behind the formation of it. One persistent problem that the urban kibbutzim have faced is that they tend to disintegrate more easily. And that probably has to do with the fact that they're just less isolated, and so people have constant communication with other people. Probably also has to do with the fact that advanced capitalism tends to move people around a lot, so it makes it more difficult for wage laborers to stay in one place. So there's a kibbutz that could sort of broadly be called an anarchist kibbutz in Israel. It's called the Samar kibbutz. It's been in existence since 1976, and one of its main reasons for foundation was the belief in a more individualistic approach to community. So something that's less extremely or oppressively communitarian. It sought to correct the stifling and oppressive collectivism that existed in the traditional kibbutz. It's a rural kibbutz, and it's relying on agriculture and various other ventures and workers' collectives. They're less averse to traditional direct democracy structures than the Tammuz kibbutz. You actually do have decisions made by a majority. Communal goods and services are arranged by the treasurer in conjunction with the community in meetings to provide necessities. And for purchases that are made outside the kibbutz, such as travel and items of interest, they historically had a money box. And the money box was kept by the treasurer. There would be a certain amount of surplus, minus insurance and things like that, that they had. And the surplus would just be placed in the money box, and people would take it as needed. They felt that this was actually ended up being too communitarian and oppressive because people are afraid to go to the money box. So eventually they ended up just issuing everybody debit cards. And the promise is not to look at what's going on. People just try to act responsibly. So Musa, who was asked how well this worked, said, "I wake up every morning surprised that it's still working." But it's happened to work pretty well so far. So Musa was sent, actually this guy was sent by Kibbutz Artsy, sort of like as a mole in 1978, to talk some sense into these crazy anarchists who formed the Samar Kibbutz. And he was told it was this place of like drugs and orgies and everybody was insane. And instead he found it very successful in a functioning kibbutz and then left Kibbutz Artsy and stayed there. And he's still there as of this day. Despite the intention of the Samar kibbutz, though, also to be egalitarian, female members complain of sexism in the distribution of labor. Women are still functionally responsible for most of the household chores and childminding also in this kibbutz. In addition, the Samar kibbutz is isolated, and it has almost no effect on the wider community. It's basically totally alone and isolated in its ideals, and there's no possibility for mutual aid or connection with the larger federation. So, while anarchism is mentioned explicitly by many members, the notion of radical egalitarian anarchist communism as an international movement is not discussed. So, anarchism has clearly had effects on the kibbutz movement, and yet the movement itself is a very peculiar, syncretic political movement, and it has a bunch of different contradictory sources, and nationalism is parts of it, and religious, you know, parts. So it's very difficult to talk about it as a monolithic whole. You really have to look at the various different strains and currents. The movement was formed initially out of the crucible of extreme racism and genocide that was occurring in Europe. And so that's a lot of where this nationalism folds in aspects of socialism, Marxism, cultural Judaism, and egalitarianism. And the main reason I think that this movement should interest anarchist communists is it's a proof of concept of communism and direct democracy. And we can learn a lot of things about the way that it has functioned there. And we can learn a lot of things about the way that it's failed. And especially, I think, what's interesting is that in terms of communism, the thing that they haven't been able to demonstrate is large-scale federated mutual aid. And I think that's something that we're really going to have to seriously work on as anarchist communists in the future. I think they also serve as a proof of the utility of having a proof of concept. The fact that the movement grew to be 5% of the population. Even if you remove 75% of the kibbutz members who currently exist in partially or totally capitalized or capitalist-sized kibbutzim, we're still talking about over 1% of the population of Israel. So that's a very significant factor. and it changes the way people think about communism as whether or not it's viable or not. So I think that, you know, if we had some quasi-communist modes of production in Dublin that constituted 1% of the population, you know, 10,000 people were existing in something like that, it might change the way people think of it as a viable means of reorganizing society. And, yeah, that's pretty much it. Any questions?
That's right. He's in charge after this.
you kind of referred to it a bit at the end, but what was kind of the ideology that the whole thing arose from, or who had the first idea to actually, not just that we're going back to the Holy Land, but we're going to go back in these sort of egalitarian communes, or was sort of the mishmash of ideas? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the second Aliyot was fairly homogeneous in being egalitarian and Marxist influenced, and it tended not to be. I mean, there were statist, there were lots of different threads in Marxism that were going through there. There were non-statist threads and statist threads of communist ideas. But a lot of it was formed also by ideas of getting back to the land and sort of rugged ideas of, you know, being a peasant again or something like that, getting out of the factories and the workshops.
Just contribute to that, I think, in terms of some of the aspirations of people coming from the European Ashkenazi Jewish background. You have to be aware that's a background where for centuries Jews were banned from working the land or any form of direct production. So that's part of, you know, sort of goes along with the whole concept of socialism, the dignity of labor and stuff, is also to actually become direct producers again, not to be trapped within a society where you're both barred from being a direct producer and then at the same time subject to discrimination, etc. So I think they're sort of tied together.
Has it gone the full circle now after the instances of non-kibbutz members who were working there and unionized or working with strikes on team that you know of?
Having strikes on kibbutz team?
Yeah.
Like Thai laborers or whatever? That's an interesting question. I don't know of any strikes of Thai laborers on. It's almost dominated by Thai laborers. It seems like most of the wage laborers tend to be Thai from Thailand. But I haven't heard of anything, but that's a very interesting question. I'll have to look at that. But I think one other thing that's interesting is the way in which like they became capitalized. A lot of it has to do with the way that the state started giving money to and subsidizing several of them. And when they started accepting money from the state, then it was all downhill from there. But also taking out loans from the banks is also very dangerous.
James, the taking out of loans in the 70s sounds like what happened to a lot of African and Latin American countries, and then they were hit with massive debts then in the early 80s. The urban kibbutzes, people live in a concentrated area together then in those cities.
Yeah, like the Tamos kibbutzes, like they bought an apartment complex, and everybody lives in there. They have a common area, they have a common eating area, but then you also have, like, apartment rooms. And so they communally maintain these various the meeting rooms and the common areas and stuff like that. And some members also get wages from the kibbutz to work locally for things that that people aren't doing or won't do.
Well, there's much of an overlap in terms of people living in sort of urban communities and sort of activity outside it, like involvement with campaigns outside the kibbutz or like union workplace stuff or kind of radical politics.
Yeah, none of the traditional kibbutzim had like basically any contact with the outside world. They were totally inwardly focused. But the urban kibbutz movement is definitely that's one of the big factors, is that they want to influence the rest of society, and so that's one of the main reasons. It's that, and there's two actions. Like there's people who want to more community that are coming into it, and there's also people who want, who are coming from the kibbutz movement and want to be outward seeking. So,
Paul, again.
No, I've forgotten what it was. So I'll come back.
I was going to ask: is there compulsive military service in Israel? Did that affect the people from the kibbutz seeing have to serve in the army, and did that also mean, you know, work as a way to change some of the ideals?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally screwed things up. I mean, like, for instance, like, they largely have, people from the kibbutz have largely formed like an officer class in the Israeli army, and it's got all, you know, there's all kinds of weird politics and power politics at play there. So I'm sure it had, I mean, basically the character of the kibbutz has sort of started to go downhill at the formation of the state, Israeli state, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm interested in decision-making structures. Do all the kibbutzes have their own decision-making structures? And do you know anything about the processes that they use?
Yeah, I mean, like, traditionally, a lot of them, like the Ganya, etc., had a council of elders kind of way of doing things, where there'd be some old men sitting in a room deciding who would be on the work lists and stuff like that. So a lot of them were not very egalitarian in their actual decision-making structures. So I think the Samar Kibbutz is actually not very representative of the way the decisions were made.
Is there any level of coordination between them or across, sort of,
yeah, I mean, there were a few examples that I could find, but they were very minor. There was, like, some examples of trading goods between two different kibbutzim, but, like, for the most part, like, during the period where they were very ideologically communist, they were all working in agriculture, and mostly growing the same sorts of things. So there wasn't that much mutual aid that could actually occur, and if one was affected by a drought in Israel, another would be affected by the same drought, probably largely to the same extent. So there wasn't that much going on. After they industrialized, during the period of industrialization, was the period where they were taking out all these loans, quickly ended up in a situation where, you know, wage labor was reintroduced and stuff like that. And at that point, you know, once they actually had all this capital for production, they probably would have been something that was much more possible. But at the same time, it became less likely because they were less ideologically focused and became more and more capitalist. So,
and just relating to that, at the time when sort of the more communist influences existed, was there much level of sort of trade with sort of the market outside, if you like, or did they deal with capitalism, if you like, in its crudest form outside of?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the interface to capitalism in the kibbutzim was, you know, an export economy. So they exported and then they would buy goods with money from selling off agricultural goods. So it was like a very small state in a sense, you know, because the border was at the kibbutz.
James.
And two things. One, no Arabs ever got in to any of these kibbutzim?
Yeah, I think there have been a couple of attempts to have Palestinian Jewish kibbutzim, but I think I didn't find anything that was of note in that. Yeah.
Second, just a comment to the rather harsh version of communism reminds me of Kuhn's initial critique of Marxism, communism, the communism of the Barretts. Or in Sparta, but you mentioned, I think, the Samar collective and the debit card. Say, everybody can draw a debit card and they're kind of basically trusted. But the difficulty with that, it seems to me, is that it only takes one person, one time, to absolutely fuck it up, and then they've lost all their money. So it's quite a big risk unless they have some other sort of system or limits or periodic monitoring or something like that.
Right. The collective cash box is not the full funding. So the treasurer would decide on all of the overhead and some insurance, some amount of money that would be needed to, you know, the slush fund or whatever, And after everything was paid for the month, then there'd be some surplus, or you know, they'd have the surplus over the year. So that is actually paying out of surplus. So everybody would share a surplus.
And I presume that if I had the debit card and I went off and bought a Ferrari or something, then that would be traceable.
It would be traceable, no, yeah, theoretically, yeah.
Ferrari probably, yeah.
Yeah. Probably. Not many people park in a Ferrari inside the olive oil.
Cossy. Oh, no, I was just wondering, like, what was the maximum maybe percentage of Israeli agriculture that they ever would have accounted for? Was it ever quite high, even in the early days? Or
I'd say it's still quite high.
Is it not?
Yeah, I can't tell you exactly, but I think it's relatively big. Because if you... I'll check. I'll find out.
I was just going to ask you, why Thailand? Where did the Thai workers come from?
Thailand.
No, but why are they all Thais, and why did they all like, end up in Israel? That's, all right. Silly question. Anyway.
One of the things I'd heard about kibbutzes is that one of the problems they had was in reproducing themselves and that young people tend to leave. Is that still the case? Or is there any new young people coming back?
Well, there's actually like a psychological problem. But if you grow up in a communal situation with a load of kids, your brain automatically assumes they're all siblings. And so it's very difficult to find pairing among people in the same kibbutz. What's that?
Western America effect.
Yeah, exactly. So what would tend to happen is they'd either jump to a different kibbutz, or they'd have, you know, trades there, or they'd leave the kibbutz team altogether. But yeah, I think that's sort of an insurmountable problem if you have a community that small.
Big disco in between two.
Don't want you. Kicking it for us, Crossy. You had a question.
Are they, I know you say they're not, they're very small, political, but so far as they are political, do they have to carry much weight in Israeli politics if there were to issue statements?
No, they carry huge weight, and it's also a source of sort of tension in the society there, because they've gotten bailed out and loans, and they've gotten, you know, just grants and support from the government in different ways, and, you know, special favors, and the politicians have often come out of the kibbutz team, so...
It's like the farmers here, then.
Except the kibbutz probably produce more.
The kind of obvious difficult question is the whole question of the Palestinians, because a lot of the kibbutz's organization sounds quite military in character, but also this whole thing with, you know, a lot of them being the actual officer corps of the army. To what extent are the kibbutzes an important part of the process by which the Palestinians were expelled? My impression is that the other half of that question was to what extent, if any, other kibbutzes who actually are in opposition to that, the process in Israel today. The only thing I know is one of my contacts in Israel, an old guy called Ilan Chief, was expelled from the kibbutz he was in the 1960s for anti-Zionist activity. So it suggests that there's very, very little room for actually having an idea that, you know, okay, all this internal egalitarian stuff is very nice, but what about the Palestinians? There's not much room for that. But what are your impressions?
Yeah, I think that's fairly accurate impression. In addition to that, I think in the first Aliyot, I said that it didn't set too much of the character, but I actually, during that period, a lot of the settlements that were made were on land that was not didn't have like property rights associated with it in a strong sense. And they actually would go in with rifles and come in and it was very militaristic in the way that they would take the land and basically stake it out, start doing agriculture while maintaining a citizen's militia on it. So there was definitely, that's been a character of the settlement from the very first Aliyot. I think that, you know, there have been elements that have tried to get away from that at various times, but I think it's still... especially with the support of the Israeli state and the way that the Israeli state has tied itself in with them, has made it that sort of not a possibility. So,
James?
Are secular recently occupied territories forming any kibbutzim? Or is that just a thing of the past?
I don't know. I don't know of any doing that.
think you'd find that most settlers in the occupied territories would be from an American commie-hating type of tendency, basically. They'd be mostly Americans and very commie-hating, so and they get quite enough subsidies from the States, so they don't have to worry too much about the general outside.
Despite the criticisms, the kibbutz are also really interested in terms of gender and gender roles. It's something I'd at some point be interested in looking more about, especially in terms of child rearing. I remember hearing that a lot of kibbutzes, as they went on, they changed the communal child rearing to become less communal. So parents would have apartments and kids would spend sometimes in apartments, sometimes in dormitories. But I think that's, be something to be worth looking at. It's quite an interesting sort of social experiment and different ways to run society.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think almost all of them moved away from the really heavy communitarian mass bedding for the children and stuff like that, the communal sleeping halls, etc. I think they basically all have stopped doing that. But it was an interesting experiment.
Even the teapots. Are the number of people seen, or number of people involved, is it growing or declining? Or?
I think it's declining, but it depends on how you count it, I think.
The overall population's growing.
Yeah.
So maybe the percentage must be declining.
Yeah. There's a huge influx from Russia, former Soviet states.